Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Ted Kooser is a two-time U.S. Poet Laureate. His collection Delights and Shadows won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2005. In honor of the centennial of the Pulitzer Prize, the South Dakota Humanities Council continues to bring Pulitzer winners to the state, and Pulitzer winners continue to stop by Dakota Midday. I caught up with Ted Kooser this weekend at the South Dakota Festival of Books in Brookings. Here's our conversation.
Is writing still fun for you?
Absolutely.
You're still having a good time with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, writing can be discouraging, but when it is going well, it's wonderfully satisfying.
Does it always go well now at this point in your career?
No, not at all.
How do you handle
it? I write every morning for a couple of hours, and in an average month, I might have two really good days, and the rest of it is just failure. And I've said this often, that if you're not sitting there on the 2 days that the good one comes by, you're not going to get it at all. So it's very important to show up for work.
What does failure, when you use that word, what do you mean by that?
Well, failure would be a poem for me that I can just never quite get it to the point where it really has what I want in it, you know, like that it doesn't end with the kind of oomph that I want it to have, you know, it feels slight and not too terribly energetic, that sort of thing, you know.
Do you get discouraged, or has experience taught you to work through that without an emotional, you know, reaction?
Well, I occasionally get a little discouraged if for a while I have a kind of, I wouldn't call it a writer's block, but I get away from it for whatever reason and I can't get back to it. It's become such a part of my identity and my routine that when I'm not doing it, I just feel odd. But as far as discouraged, no, because it always comes back. It seems to, anyway.
Has there been a period of time where you did not write or draw or create? Have you gone through a spell where you actually did not show up for your own work?
Sometimes for a couple of months, maybe, that's happened, you know. And there's never any particular reason why, you know. I just sort of drift away from it a little bit, and then kind of come scrambling back at the end, you know. And I had a couple months ago, several months spell of not being able to write anything that I liked at all. And so as a result of that, I wasn't exercising my disciplines as far as doing it every day. And then whatever it was waiting for me to come back to it, because then I had a very productive time from then on, you know.
What does it feel like when it's going really well?
There's nothing that feels better than that.
Can you describe it to me?
It's that, so, you know, it's being surprised by what you can do. you know, my work is very highly metaphorical, and metaphors are something that arise spontaneously. They are not something that you can invent or fabricate. They are emotional and mental associations that just arise in the process of writing. And when one of those flies in from the side and it's a really good one, it's just like, woo, you know, it's just marvelous, you know. Where did that come from?
So when you found out you won the Pulitzer, what was that moment like?
Well, I'll tell you, what happened was I was at home, and the phone rang, and I answered the phone, and it was the communications person at the University of Nebraska, Meg Lauerman is her name, and she called and she said, "We would like a statement from you about winning the Pulitzer Prize," and I had no idea that, and I was staggered by it, and I went out. And I'd been raking leaves in the yard, even though it was, you know, it's in the spring when it's announced, but I was doing some spring yard cleanup. And I stretched out in a pile of leaves, looking up at the sky, wondering what was coming next, you know. And just then the Omaha World Herald photographer came down the driveway in his van, you know, to photograph me. Fortunately, I got up before the photograph was taken, you know, but it was like that, you know, it was a complete surprise. Wonderful.
How did things change after that day? What did it do to you as a poet to have been honored like that?
Well, as far as my ability to write or anything like that, it didn't, you know, that didn't change anything, you know. But it brought me a tremendous amount of readers, people who had never heard of my work, would heard about it that way, and that was a wonderful benefit in that, you know, that's what it's all about for me, is reaching people. And so all of a sudden I reached a whole lot more of them, you know. And the Pulitzers are awarded at a luncheon at Columbia, and I had to fly to New York to go to the luncheon and everything, and I hate flying, you know, and so that was sort of an effort, but I figured I better do that, you know. It was very interesting that particular book had received a somewhat critical review in the LA Times, and I'd been kind of disappointed in that review had appeared in such a prominent place, and then the Pulitzer Prize came, and I told somebody about that, and they said, well, the Pulitzer Prize trumps the review in the LA Times.
You know, so. We can all agree,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Will you tell me about your journals, because you must, or your, you know, how you sort of keep and store your writing. You've written so much by showing up every day, and you're an artist as well.
Well, I work in spiral-bound artist sketchbooks. With a real heavy paper. I've used the same kind for years and years, kind of watercolor paper, really. And I begin each day by writing a little journal entry as to what happened the day before, and then I just sit with my notebook. And I write random things in there, and sometimes one will steer off into something that looks like it might become a poem. And let's say that I can fabricate what might be four or five lines that would open a poem like that. Then I'll go to my computer and type those lines in and print it off and then cut it out with a pair of scissors and glue it in the notebook. And then write on top of that draft. And so the notebooks are all these sort of, in effect, collages or montages of fragments, you know, that build up. And so a poem would develop over the course of maybe three full pages, you know, and it would have the early drafts pasted in and so on. And the advantage of that is that the early drafts are there is that frequently I overwrite. I write too long until some of the blood goes out of it. And then I can back up and say, well, you know, this looked better back here. And I have, you know, I don't know how many of those notebooks I filled over the years, you know. Usually one about every 6 months because my handwriting's very small.
Do you go back and look at where you were a few years ago, or do they just live on the shelf once you're on to a fresh notebook?
Well, you know, to some degree you have to go back a little bit in that, you know, when it comes time to put a book together, you go back and see where you were and what during that period. It usually takes me about 10 years to do a book of poems that I really feel comfortable with, so there's quite a bit of span of time in there, you know, and so I do go back, but I don't go back and very infrequently would I tinker with an old poem, you know. I figure that it was right at that time and it doesn't have to be, I mean, if it feels funny now, it was still right then, you know, so.
You're at the point in your career, I'm guessing, that if you write something, there's going to be somebody who wants to publish it. Do you have a greater hesitation then to publish and satisfy yourself first, because it's no longer that gatekeeper sort of relationship?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it is a problem, I think. So as a result, when I send my poems to literary magazines now, I send them only to those magazines that I know that I can trust them to tell me when it isn't worth it, you know. There are all these young startup literary magazines that are always looking for work, you know, and they'll invite work and everything, and you have to be very careful what you send them because they're going to take whatever they get, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I don't send out my work compulsively, you know. Several times a year I might make a little group and send them somewhere. And places like the Kenyon Review, where I know the poetry editor and I know he'll tell me when something's not right, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you start feeling that this was your job or your, you talked about reaching readers. Was there a moment that you thought, yeah, this is my job, this is what I'm doing?
Yeah, in exactly those words, I think. You know, what happened was I had been writing poems for quite a long time and not, you know, not thinking about that kind of thing. And I wrote a little poem called Spring Plowing, and it is about a nest of field mice moving out of the plowed field into the fence row. And in the poem, they take on a kind of Walt Disney character in that there are these little mice moving with carrying lanterns and the whole, and the old mice are wailing, you know, and all. And you know, with the notion that mice might want to get out of the way of the plow, you know, and into a safer place. And I published that poem in a literary magazine, and a woman from Omaha wrote me and said that she had seen the poem, and she said, you know, I will never pass a plowed field in the spring again without thinking about those mice. And I thought, this is my job, that I'm going to do things to show people things like that that can, they can take into their lives and have a different way of looking at them and that kind of thing, you know. So.
If your poetry and your books and even your readings in places throughout the entire country as Poet Laureate and beyond, if they're sort of breadcrumbs that are leading readers who follow your career, what do you want those readers to get out of that? Where do you want those breadcrumbs to sort of lead them in their own life?
Maybe most of us, if not a great many people, think that their lives are humdrum and ordinary and that there's nothing exciting about their lives, you know. And if you can write a poem about a blender in somebody's kitchen and flood it with new light and new ways of looking at it and everything, then all of a sudden that blender, they have a different way of looking at that very ordinary thing in their life, you know. One of my favorite poets is a Minnesota poet named Connie Wanick. Connie is very good at that kind of thing, you know, and there are other poets doing that sort of thing, too.
How important is form to you?
Form is very important. You know, most of my poems are quite formal, although anybody looking at them at a glance would say that they're not. But I'm very careful about the number of accents in a line, the number of syllables in a line, a kind of running rhythm that runs throughout the whole poem down to the end. I've never been able to explain this. It's sort of like a rhetorical rhythm that you might find in a speech that rises and then resolves. So all those things are part of the kind of form that I'm working with, you know. Now that's not to say that I am rigid about having four accentual beats in a line, or 10 syllables in a line, but that I kind of measure a little bit that way, you know, a syllable here, a syllable there. Yeah.
Is that what helps make a poem great or successful, if you will?
It can. You know, a rhythm in a poem can bear the reader along at a pace that you want them to read it at. For instance, a very driving, iambic pentameter poem will haul the reader forward on that rhythm, you know, right to the end. Mm-hmm. Or to end a poem with a very iambic rhythm like that and end on an accent makes it feel final. So all those things are sort of in there at play. I try not to think of those things as I'm writing, though. I mean, it's detrimental to be making rational decisions about form while you're writing. While you're revising, you can do all that you want to, I think.
So what are you thinking about while you're writing?
I'm just trying to follow it, you know, to see where it goes. And, you know, I'm in a kind of, I suppose, a sort of trance in a way, you know.
How important is the space in which you write to a poet? The place where you do your work?
I'm very addicted to routines. I write in the same chair every morning. I turn on the same light every morning. I drink about the same amount of coffee every morning. I get up at the same time. I feed the dog at the same time. All that stuff, you know. If any of that is disrupted, it can be counterproductive for me, you know. And so space in that sense is pretty important, yeah. Now I wrote some I'm in this hotel here in Brookings, you know, I wrote some work this morning, you know, in there, but it was an effort to get myself situated that I could get started.
Hmm. So. Is there anything unfinished in your work right now? Do you feel like there's something that you haven't done that you're still grasping for?
Well, there's a lot of unfinished work behind me. That abandoned work, you know, things that I started that I couldn't pull off. I don't know what's out there ahead. You know, I think I'll probably just keep doing what I'm doing, which is one poem at a time. You know, that's all I want to think about is that one poem. You know, today in creative writing programs at university campuses, there's this sort of phenomenon that we called the project book, where a young poet will say, I'm going to write 30 poems about the invention of the water heater and set out to write 30 poems that way. Well, it's none of those poems is going to be any good. Maybe there might be one good water heater poem, you know, but you can't think your way into writing. You know, you have to kind of let writing happen, I think. So.
And you're always engaged in making something. How does art and drawing, painting, fit into your life as a poet?
I want to do whatever I can do to create something that will endure beyond me. To do a drawing or a painting or a poem that might have a chance of surviving me a little bit, you know, is a motivation of mine.
You think you've achieved that?
I have. Once in a while, I think I have. You know, I've got.
I
have
think some, you've achieved it in multitudes.
Well, I don't know about that. I have some poems that are in lots of literary anthologies, and they'll probably stay there. You know, at least for a while. You know, but that's not going to. The fact that I've achieved a little bit that way doesn't mean that I don't want to keep doing it, you know, so.
Right. So many writers you must meet, so many poets who say they want to write, they don't have the time, there's something that's sort of in the way between them and the work or between their work and the reader. How does that make you feel when people come up and sort of share that with you? And can you help them get to the other side?
A lot of people will say, I think I've got a book in me. And I'll say, well, before you get this book done, why don't you see if you can write a paragraph? I think that sort of gives them the idea of what this is all about, you know, that you have to start. And you may never write a book, but you might write two or three paragraphs, you know. I couldn't write a book. I mean, if somebody said, I want, you know, Kuzer, could you write a book about rural life in Nebraska, I'd say, no way could I do that. You know, it's too big of a thing, you know. But it turned out I did write one, but I wrote it in little pieces that I didn't know was going to be a book, you know, so.
Would you read for us? You brought a poem along.
Yeah, this is a new poem, and I'm just a few days old, and it is representative of how I go about writing a poem. I saw a young man writing on the back of a garbage truck, a garbage hauler. And the gestures that he was making led me into this other thing. Arabesque. A tiny ballerina of a man, little more than a child, rides on the back of a garbage truck in t-shirt, jeans, and fluorescent chartreuse vest, hanging on to the bar, pointing one foot in its dirty sneaker, stretching the muscles in that thigh and calf, throwing his long hair back, closing his eyes, holding his face to the light, awaiting to spring down into first position, there to be joined by an older man who comes skipping around from the driver's side, the two of them now in a practice pas de deux with the orchestra swirling them on, percussion of galvanized cans, cymbals of lids, and then all the instruments joined in one thunderous clamor as the great chord in the back grinds slowly open, met by the wild applause of a thousand flies.